Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning,
citizen.
Well, many of you know that my teacher always gave us advice for a talk to be brief. Well, I beg his forgiveness this morning because I don't think I can be brief. But I came across something which I found very interesting. And then that led me to sort of, I guess, creating my own theory about something. So I'm going to share that with you. And part of it will be that I will be reading some excerpts from a book. And the book is called Hold Me Tight. It has nothing to do with Zen whatsoever. Well, not totally, but for the most part, it has nothing to do with Zen. It's written by Dr. Sue Johnson. And it's a book on relationships. I'm a therapist also, for those of you who don't know. And somebody had mentioned a while ago that I should read this book. So I recently picked it up and started reading it. And just to give you a little bit of a context, part of the context for this is that, you know, scientists that study evolution know that just about every adaptation that takes place is in service of survival, the survival of the species, as Darwin put it. So most of what I'm going to read you excerpts on has to do with attachment theory, which I've always loved, having been abandoned as a child and seeing how that affected my early life and into adulthood. It always made a lot of sense to me. And the principal who presented the theory of attachment was a guy named John Bowlby, who was a psychoanalyst. But I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. So Sue Johnson, Dr. Johnson, writes, "We now know that love is, in actuality, the pinnacle of evolution, the most compelling survival mechanism of the human species. Not because it induces us to mate and reproduce. We do manage to mate without love. But because love drives us to bond emotionally with a precious few others who offer us safe haven from the storms of life. Love is our bulwark, designed to provide emotional protection so we can cope with the ups and downs of existence. We need emotional attachments with a few irreplaceable others to be physically and mentally healthy, to survive." Okay, and then there's a section in the first chapter called A New Theory of Attachment. So it's a little bit about Bowlby's history, and then it says, "But it remained for John Bowlby, a British psychiatrist, to figure out exactly what was going on. Born in 1907, Bowlby, the son of a baronet, was raised in the fashion of the upper class, primarily by nannies and governesses. His parents allowed him to join them at the dinner table after he turned 12, and then only for dessert. He was sent off to boarding school and then attended Trinity College in Cambridge. Bowlby's life departed from tradition when he volunteered to work in the innovative residential schools for emotionally maladjusted children, being started by visionaries like A.S. Neal. These schools focused on offering emotional support rather than the usual stern discipline. Bowlby rebelled against the professional dictum that the crux of patients' problems lay in their internal conflicts and unconscious fantasies." That's Freudian psychology. "Bowlby insisted the problems were mostly external, rooted in real relationships with real people. Working with disturbed youngsters at the child guidance clinics in London, he began to believe that blighted relationships with parents had left them with only a few negative ways to deal with basic feelings and needs. Later in 1938, as a beginning clinician under the supervision of the noted analyst Melanie Klein, Bowlby was assigned a young hyperactive boy who had an extremely anxious mother. He was not allowed to talk to the mother. However, since only the child's projections and fantasies were deemed of interest," so that meant that Bowlby was not allowed to talk to the mother, "that infuriated Bowlby. His experience spurred him to formulate his own idea, namely that the quality of the connection to loved ones and early emotional deprivation is the key to development of personality and to an individual's habitual way of connecting with others. And then Sue Johnson goes on to write, following World War II, Bowlby was asked by the World Health Organization to do a study of European children left homeless and orphaned by conflict. His findings confirmed his belief in the reality of emotional starvation and his conviction that loving contact is as important as physical nutrition. Let me repeat that. Loving contact is as important as physical nutrition. Along with his studies and observations, Bowlby was impressed by Charles Darwin's ideas of how natural selection favors responses that help survival. Responses that help survival. Bowlby came to the conclusion that keeping precious others close is a brilliant survival technique wired in by evolution. So it's in our genetic makeup. So at one point, Bowlby became connected to a Canadian researcher named Mary Ainsworth, who became his assistant and showed him how to do research that would support his view. She devised a very simple experiment. I'm going to read some of this to you because to me it's fascinating. Is this boring you to death or? Okay. Okay, good. Because I found it really interesting. So anyway, so this Mary Ainsworth comes up with this experiment to look at four behaviors that Bowlby and she believed were basic to attachment. That we monitor and maintain emotional physical closeness with our beloved. That we reach out for this person when we are upset, unsure, or feeling down. That we miss this person when we are apart. And that we count on this person to be there for us when we go out into the world and explore. Now, interestingly enough, the experiment was called the Strange Situation and has generated literally thousands of scientific studies and revolutionized developmental psychology. A researcher invites a mother and a child into an unfamiliar room. After a few minutes, the mother leaves the child alone with the researcher, who tries to offer comfort if needed. 3 minutes later, the mother comes back. This separation and reunion are repeated again after this. Now, the majority of children are upset when their mothers walk out. They rock themselves, they cry, they throw toys. But some prove more emotionally resilient. They calm themselves quickly and effectively, reconnect easily with their mothers on their return, and rapidly resume playing while checking to make sure that their moms are still around. They seem confident that their mothers will be there if needed. Less resilient youngsters, however, are anxious and aggressive, or detached and distant on their mother's return. The kids who can calm themselves usually have warmer, more responsive mothers, while the moms of the angry kids are unpredictable in their behavior, and the moms of detached kids are colder and dismissive. In these simple studies of disconnection and reconnection, Bowlby saw love in action and began to code its patterns. And then she includes this study by Harry Harlow, who was a contemporary of Bowlby's and a psychologist at the University of Wisconsin, who drew attention to this idea by what he called contact comfort, and reporting some dramatic research with young monkeys that were separated from their mothers at birth. And Harlow discovered that the isolated infants were so hungry for connection that when given the choice between a mother made out of wire who dispensed food and a soft cloth mother without food, they would choose the squishy rag mother almost every time. So attachment theory, at first ridiculed and despised, eventually revolutionized child-rearing methods in North America. Now, I'm going to jump forward, because this book is about love relationships, and just present some information there, and then actually, believe it or not, this is going to connect, I think, to our practice. So Bowlby died in 1990, and he did not live to see what was referred to as the second revolution of attachment theory. Bowlby himself had maintained that adults have the same need for attachment, because he had studied World War II widows and discovered that they exhibited behavior patterns similar to those of homeless youngsters. So adults have the same need for attachment. This is not just confined to children, young children. Most important, the attachment view of love was, and perhaps still is, radically out of line with our culture's established and psychological ideas of adulthood. That is, that maturity means being independent and self-sufficient. Psychologists, if you think about it, and if you're familiar with the psychological world at all, we hear psychologists use words like undifferentiated, codependent, symbiotic, or even fused to describe people who seem to be unable to maintain self-sufficient or definitely assert themselves with others. In contrast, Bowlby talked about affective dependency and how being able, from the cradle to the grave, to turn to others for emotional support, and how that is a source of strength and a source of mental health. So fast forward to the therapy room. Oh, let me just backtrack. There's a number of connections between attachment and physical health. Many, many connections. I'll just give you a quick little one here. It's not just whether or not we have these close relationships in our lives, but the quality of these relationships matters also. Negative relationships undermine our health. In Cleveland, researchers at Case Western University asked men with a history of angina and high blood pressure one question. Does your wife show her love? Those who answered no suffered almost twice as many angina episodes during the next 5 years as those who answered yes. Women's hearts are affected too. Women who view their marriages as strained and having regular hostile interactions with their partners are more likely to have significantly elevated blood pressure and higher level of stress hormones compared with women in happy marriages. Yet another study found that women who had had a heart attack stood a threefold higher risk of having another if there was discord in their marriage. So she goes on to describe all of the health consequences of lack of having attachment to significant others for adults. Now, fast forward to the therapy room. And she talks about how this adaptive behavior, this need to have healthy attachments, actually supports survival. Nat and Carrie sit in stubborn silence until Carrie cracks and sobs on how shocked and betrayed she feels about Nat's affair. Nat, with an air of frustration, ticks off his reasons for the affair. I've told you again and again why it happened. I've come clean, and geez, it was 2 years ago. It's in the past. Isn't it time you got over it and forgave me? You don't know the meaning of clean, shrieks Carrie. Then her voice falls to a whisper. You don't care about me, about my hurt. You just want everything to go back the way it was. She starts to cry and stares at the floor. I ask each couple, this is Sue Johnson, what they think the basic problem is in their relationship and what the solution might be. They dig in a bit and offer up their ideas. Sally says Jay is too controlling. He has to be taught how to share power more equitably. Chris suggests that he and Jane have such different personalities that agreement on parenting style is impossible. They could settle the issue by taking a parenting course from an expert. Nat is convinced that Carrie has a sex hang-up. Maybe they should see a sex therapist so they can get back to being happy in the bedroom. These couples are trying hard to make sense of their distress, but their formulations are missing the mark. Their explanations are just the tip of the iceberg, the superficial, tangible crest of a big block of trouble, many therapists would agree. So what is the real problem that lies beneath? If I ask therapists, many would say the couples are caught up in a destructive power struggle or caustic fighting patterns, and what they need to do is learn how to negotiate and improve their communication skills. But counselors, too, are missing the crux of the issue. They've just worked their way down the iceberg to the waterline. We have to dive below to discover the basic problem. These couples have disconnected emotionally. They don't feel emotionally safe with each other. What couples and therapists too often do not see is that most fights are really to protest our emotional disconnection. Underneath all the distress, partners are asking each other, can I count on you? Can I depend on you? Are you there for me? Will you respond to me when I need, when I call? Do I matter to you? Am I valued and accepted by you? Do you need me? Rely on me. And she refers to this as primal panic, that the real distress comes from the broken attachment, and that for any of the psychological couples work to be effective, we must, and there's a whole bunch of exercises and other things, we must be secure in our fundamental attachment with each other, because it's grounded in the fight or flight response. It's grounded in our very survival. So, having said all that, and I appreciate your indulging that, you know, having read these sections in the book about attachment theory and how love connections are really primal adaptations for individual survival, started me thinking about the possibility that the deep need for spirituality, you think of how many people have a need for spirituality, how many people have this angst that something is missing in their life, and so they go on a spiritual search. So could it be that this possibility, that there's a possibility, that there's a deep need about the possibility that the deep need for spirituality could possibly be a survival mechanism on an even greater scale than the one proposed by Bowlby and others? I thought of Rumi and his poetry. And it's been said his poetry has as its essential theme longing and the longing and search for union with the divine. And Rumi himself wrote, longing is the core of mystery. Longing itself brings the cure. So is there wired in us not only a desire for human connection, which, as I have already mentioned, is a survival mechanism, but also a longing for union with the divine, which calls us to realize our fundamental intrinsic connection, not only to each other, but to the universe itself? Could this calling be the ultimate survival mechanism? The natural result of this divine connection is to feel love, compassion, and a profound sense of universal oneness. If more and more people experience this union, wouldn't this dramatically increase the likelihood that we would be saved not only as individuals, but as a species? The experience, of course, of this connection in Zen we call enlightenment. What is the current state of affairs in the world today? Most people on the planet, across all cultures, live their lives from a dualistic perspective, out of touch with the underlying unity that exists between all things. This is the life of me and you, us and them. Living a life that only has a dualistic perspective leads to living a life based on self-interest as opposed to community or global interest. From this perspective, anyone that is not me or not us is seen as a threat. There is no surprise to anyone. This is no surprise to anyone who listens to the evening news. Living this way causes powerful feelings of fear, anxiety, insecurity, and alienation. At the same time, it stirs up a deep longing, I believe, for reconnection, a sense of oneness. We carry in our being a sense that something is missing. There is a void in our lives in which our very survival feels threatened, and we grieve our loss of this connection. We long to reconnect with the human family, with the leaves falling in autumn, with the crescent moon hanging in the next to Venus in the western sky, with Basho's frog jumping into an ancient pond. For many of us, the longing that brought us to Zen practice is itself the cure, because it creates in us the energy to go deeper into life and experience a union with the divine. It allows us to have a more peaceful existence individually and to engage life more holistically. As I read earlier, the psychological literature, which is ample, focuses on the importance of our individual human connections. and how important the quality of those connections are, not only to our well-being, but to our individual survival. The question that I have raised is the actualization of healthy, loving connections enough? Or has a significant piece been left out of what is necessary for humans to thrive, actualize, and survive as a species? So, you know, I would add that, you know, I'm not just talking about our connection to each other, but our connection to everything. Look at what's happening to the environment. If we don't connect or reconnect to the environment, we will not survive. And you can look at so many different aspects of being in that same way. So I humbly offer that perhaps being here, sitting here, is a survival mechanism that we are sharing together. Thank you.